1 Kings chapter 11, and I'm going to begin reading verse 1. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, "You must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods." Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely, as David his father had done. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives, who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, "Since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David, your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David my servant and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen."
Our reading continues in 1 Kings 11, starting at verse 26. "Also, Jeroboam, son of Nebat, rebelled against the king. He was one of Solomon's officials, an Ephraimite from Zerida, and his mother was a widow named Zeruah. Here's the account of how he rebelled against the king. Solomon had built the terraces and had filled in the gap in the wall of the city of David his father. Now Jeroboam was a man of standing, and when Solomon saw how well the young man did his work, he put him in charge of the whole labor force of the tribes of Joseph. About that time, Jeroboam was going out of Jerusalem, and Ahijah, the prophet of Shiloh, met him on the way, wearing a new cloak. The two of them were alone out in the country, and Ahijah took hold of the new cloak he was wearing and tore it into 12 pieces. Then he said to Jeroboam, 'Take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. See, I am going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand and give you 10 tribes. But for the sake of my servant David and the city of Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, he will have one tribe. I will do this because they have forsaken me and worship Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the son of Moabites, and Molech, the son of the god of Ammonites, and have not walked in obedience to me, nor done what is right in my eyes, nor kept my decrees and laws as David, Solomon's father, did. I will not take the whole kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I have made him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of David my servant, whom I chose, and who obey my commands and decrees. I will take the kingdom from his son's hands and give you 10 tribes. I will give one tribe to his son, so that David my servant may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I chose to put my name. However, as for you, I will take you, and you will rule over all that your heart desires. You will be king over Israel, if you do whatever I command you and walk in obedience to me and do what is right in my eyes by obeying my decrees and commands, as David my servant did, I will be with you. I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one I built for David, and will give Israel to you. I will humble David's descendants because of this, but not forever. Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam fled to Egypt, to Shishak, the king, and stayed there until Solomon's death. As for the other events of Solomon's reign, all he did and the wisdom he displayed, are they not written in the book of the Annals of Solomon? Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel for 40 years. Then he rested with his ancestors and was buried in the city of David his father. And Rehoboam, his son, succeeded him as king.
So please keep that open. We're going to focus on the first half of the passage that was read just a few minutes ago. Now, I think one of the most powerful feelings in this world is that of disappointment, of shattered dreams and disillusionment. That new thing that we've been saving up for finally arrives, but then it doesn't do quite what it's meant to do, or it gets damaged. That exciting event, a holiday, a wedding, a day out, well, it comes and it's okay, and then it's passed and life rolls on. Or that moment when you realize your hero has feet of clay. Like when a sports star falls from grace. I know we've got some keen cyclists here in the church. What does it feel like when, say, a Lance Armstrong is stripped of his achievements because he cheated? Or when a Chris Froome fails a drugs test? It happens across the world of sport and celebrities. Tiger Woods, greatest golfer of his generation, crushed by the revelations about his affairs. Harvey Weinstein, not quite sure how to pronounce his surname, but prize-winning film producer, brought down by his exploitative behaviour. Jimmy Savile, a flamboyant entertainer who disguised his dark secret for many years. How do you feel when you discover those feet of clay, those flaws? It doesn't have to be someone famous. Could be a respected friend, or a supportive boss, or a mature Christian. I've not been around all that long as an adult and in church life, and already I've seen two gifted preachers who are leading growing churches. It's all going so well for them, and yet it all came crashing down when their adultery came to light. And the hurt it caused their wives, their families, their congregations, it's horrendous. These things can be profoundly unsettling. That sense of disappointment and disillusionment. It could have been so good. And yet it all went so, so wrong. Now I know that's quite a heavy start to this sermon, but it's exactly the sort of feeling that we get as we read 1 Kings 11. Broken dreams. It was all going so well. Remember what we've seen in Solomon's reign over the last few months as we've looked at these chapters. He's the son of David, heir to God's wonderful promises and blessings for his people. He receives wisdom and wealth. He enjoys peace and prosperity. He builds a fantastic temple, a place to meet with God. He has two visions where God speaks to him personally to reassure Solomon of his presence. He's famous across the region with kings and queens flocking to seek his advice and admire his achievements. Really, it's hard to imagine anything much better than life in Solomon's kingdom. But then we hit chapter 11 and it shows us that there's a problem. And in fact, we're taking right to the heart of the problem here. There are several areas that could be criticized in Solomon's reign. The times when violence seemed to obscure justice. The slave labor. The excessive wealth and horses that God's law warned against. The links with Egypt. The number of wives he had. But listen to how God puts his finger on what really is the heart of the problem. Let's read again from verse 1. Do follow along with me. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from the nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David his father had done. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all of his foreign wives, who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. Did you spot the problem here? Back over the page in verse 4. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. So it's not just that he had lots of wives, although the Bible does say that marriage should be between one man and one woman. It's not just that they were foreign women in a sort of racist way. The problem was that they worshipped other gods. It was a spiritual problem. And Solomon didn't just let them get on with their worship. He built shrines near Jerusalem for these gods, and he participated in their worship. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. So the heart of the problem? Well, it was actually his heart. He wasn't fully devoted to the one true God. Instead, his heart went chasing after other idols, unlike David, his father. Now, David wasn't perfect. Anyone who knows his story will know of the one particularly catastrophic mistake in the middle of his reign that led to huge problems down the track. But David was repentant. His heart was humble. He turned back to God and asked for forgiveness. He recognized what he had done was wrong. He took responsibility and faced up to the consequences. It was tough, but through his mistakes, he learned more of God's grace. He remained fully devoted to the Lord his God. But Solomon here is different. He makes mistakes, and yet he doesn't recognize it. He just keeps on going in the same destructive direction. He's not repentant. He's not humble and honest with himself. And so his heart isn't fully devoted to his God. In fact, his heart is all over the place. Bit of God and Bible one day, a bit of maybe Buddhism and meditation another day, a bit of consumerism and shopping therapy the next day, a bit of free love, sexual exploration another day, a bit of strict detox to round it all off, self-flagellation and doing penance. A sort of mixture of all sorts, a pick-and-mix faith that completely undermines the uniqueness and supremacy of the one true God. And that really is the problem. There is only one true God. All the others are fake gods. They're powerless and empty. And yet, they're also plausible and sort of attractive. They make it seem like it's worth our while to pursue them. And idolatry is ultimately a matter of the heart. It's about what we live for what we love. I wonder what that would be for you. Because the thing is, it's not always obvious what we're worshipping. There aren't usually shrines and little statues involved. So we need to approach it from a slightly different angle. Perhaps think about these questions. What am I most afraid of? Or what do I long for most passionately? Or where do I run for comfort? What makes me most angry? Those are the sort of things that help us to see what we're actually worshipping. I've got a whole list of those sorts of questions that help us to spot idolatry in our hearts. What sort of things have come to mind? My hobbies, having a model family, success in the workplace, a satisfying marriage, a full bank account, being respected and popular. I mean, these are all good things. It's just when we turn them into gods, they become destructive. And that's what went wrong for Solomon. God gave him everything you could dream of having. And yet he still wanted more. He wanted to offer a bit of worship to some other gods. And so his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God. The God who gave that greatest commandment. Do you remember it? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. Solomon hadn't just slipped up in a small way. He had broken the greatest commandment. His heart wasn't in the right place. And that's the heart of the problem. And perhaps we wonder, how did it get like this? It all looked so good over the last few chapters. Well, as it says here, God had warned his people not to marry men and women from other nations. And this wasn't some kind of nationalistic pride. Israel first, make Israel great again. It was just plain religious common sense. You can't be joined together in the closest relationship of marriage. You can't raise children together in harmony and unity if you worship different gods. I'm sure many of us here know people in marriages between a Christian and a non-Christian. Some of us are perhaps in relationships like that. Now, people I've spoken to who have had this experience of a Christian married to a non-Christian have often talked to me about how difficult it is to play an active part in church life when a husband or wife isn't involved at all. They'll often feel sort of left out or excluded. Now, some people do become Christians after they're married, and the Bible encourages these people in mixed marriages to try their best to make things work. But it's not easy. I remember very clearly a Christian lady, and it is often the lady, who longed for her husband to come to know Jesus. It was always uncomfortable returning to him after church. Her twin boys often wanted to stay home with Dad rather than coming to church. She did an amazing job of keeping going, but it wasn't easy. And that's why God steers people away from that situation and says to us that believers should marry believers and non-believers should marry non-believers. That's what God says to his people in the Old Testament, and you find the same idea repeated in the New Testament. In fact, the Bible would even go so far as to say that it's better not to marry than to marry into the heartache and spiritual struggle that is a mixed marriage. Numerous times I've seen Christian friends get involved with someone who isn't a Christian and reassure me that it's okay because they're friendly and open. But then within a few months or perhaps years, again and again, I've seen people leaving behind their Christian faith in order to be wholeheartedly with this other person. Solomon, for all his wisdom, married very foolishly. And that's where it all began to go wrong for him. But it didn't just happen overnight. It took time. In fact, it wasn't, it says here, until Solomon's old age that the problems really began to show. Sometimes we think, don't we, that the hardest time to be a Christian is as a young person, school, uni, young adults. So huge challenges, of course, to following Jesus as a young person. It's true. But there are huge challenges to following Jesus as an older person as well. I've not got that far quite yet, but I've observed it. The frustrations of not being sort of central and active in church life as in earlier years. A sort of deep root of bitterness and resentment about life. And sort of focusing that on God and on church leaders. A sort of destructive gossip and grumbling and separation from Christian fellowship by becoming housebound and perhaps moved to a care home closer to family. The older generation in our church family need our prayers and support. Now, when we see lovely older people, and they're such a blessing, it's so beautiful and attractive to see a dear old person who clearly loves the Lord. But that sort of godliness isn't automatic. Well, having worked in a town dominated by retired people, I've seen how old age can bring out the ugly side of people's character, turning them away from God. And Solomon is a warning to us all not to drift away from God in our old age. And Solomon shows us the heart of the problem. Broken dreams because of broken hearts. He had everything. He really had everything. The godly example of his father, the amazing experiences of meeting with God in a vision, the brilliant education and wisdom that he received from God, and yet he fell. He failed. And if he fell, this great king who had everything, well then so can we. Solomon warns us that the greatest danger to our spiritual well-being is right inside of us. It's our hearts that can so quickly turn away from the God who loves us. The end of Solomon's story makes us think about what the end of our story will be like. Solomon's does not end well. And I've deliberately spent quite a lot of time unpacking this, looking at what went wrong. We're going to move a bit more quickly through the next phase of the story. And it's the part where we turn to focus on the anger of God. God makes clear just how seriously he takes Solomon's idolatry. So look at verse 9 with me. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, since this is your attitude, and you've not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Just pause there for a moment. The Lord became angry with Solomon. What a sad moment that was. Here is the great King Solomon receiving God's verdict on his life. The Lord became angry. It's not that God flies off the handle in a fit of rage. It's not that he's in a bad mood. No, God is making a settled and measured response to Solomon's willfully destructive behavior. Solomon owed God everything. And yet Solomon wanted to try out some different gods. God had been so generous with Solomon, and yet Solomon just threw it back in his face. He ignored God's warning. He broke God's laws. He spurned God's love. And so God's anger, his settled opposition to all that is bad, comes against this pathetic, sinful rebellion of Solomon's. God takes sin seriously. He doesn't just sweep it under the carpet. He can't just ignore it. He does something about it. And I wonder, what do you think about God's response to Solomon's idolatry here? A bit disproportionate? Taking himself a bit too seriously? Well, we'll never understand God's reaction to sin and idolatry, if we haven't grasped fully his glory and greatness and goodness and grace. It's like Solomon's been invited to dinner with the Queen. And he turns up in his jeans and t-shirt and sits himself down at her place at the head of the table. Oh, that's how Solomon treats God. God's entirely right to respond the way he does. And so judgment falls on Solomon. The kingdom he's worked so hard to establish will fade and fail. And the rest of the chapter shows how it all begins to go wrong. God raises up adversaries to cause Solomon grief. Previously, he'd enjoyed peace and protection. Now, he's shown that he's not in control. And then a man called Jeroboam receives a word from God's prophet saying that he's going to end up ruling over most of Solomon's kingdom. Clearly, Solomon isn't impressed about this because he tries to kill Jeroboam. There's far worse to come. But that'll have to wait till a later stage when we can read on in the story of Kings and see what happens. It's a desperately sad ending to what should have been a wonderful and long-lasting kingdom. But that's what happens when we persist in treating God as anything less than the one true God. As soon as we start to push him away or put other things in his place, we open ourselves up to his righteous anger and his holy judgment. Solomon experiences this for himself. It's a sad and bleak ending to the greatest king Israel ever had. But there is finally, and I want to touch on this in our closing minutes, the glimmer of hope. It's there in verse 12. You saw that I stopped reading midway through the paragraph. Verse 12, the glimmer of hope. Nevertheless, God says, for the sake of David, your father, I will not do it, this judgment, during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet, I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. Oh, what mercy there is here. Solomon doesn't deserve this kindness. And yet God remembers David, the promises he'd made to David. These promises are so important because they provide the only glimmer of hope in this otherwise bleak passage. I'll just pop them up on the screen, the main part of them. God said to David back in 2 Samuel, when your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I'll raise up your offspring, Solomon, to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He's the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he will be my son. When he does wrong, I will punish him with a rod wielded by men, with floggings inflicted by human hands. But my love will never be taken away from him. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. What great promises for David's son Solomon. It is realistic what God says. I mean, whenever this son of David does wrong, he will be punished. But whatever happens, God says, David's throne will be established forever. Solomon made a mess. And just like God said, he was punished. But because of this promise to David, the line of kings from David would continue. Solomon's son would rule over one tribe, not 12. But his dynasty, it lasted for generations, ruling on the throne of David in Jerusalem. And just down in 1 Kings 11, I love verse 39. God says, I will humble David's descendants because of this, but not forever. Those last three words echo that promise in 2 Samuel 7. And they're the glimmer of hope that shines out in this otherwise bleak chapter. But not forever. Those are the words that sustained the faith of God's people through the darkest of times, through defeat and exile, through what looked like hopelessness, disappointment and disillusionment. None of their leaders were faithful to God and his word. They all failed in different ways. But those three words continued to sound, but not forever. And that is until the true Son of David came, the faithful King we all need, Jesus, the one who doesn't succumb to idolatry, whose heart is fully devoted to the Lord, the one who actually bore the anger of God, though he didn't deserve it, so that we don't have to. There is David's greater son, the one who brings the glimmer of hope, the glorious dawn of a new day, the resurrection, the one who shines as a light, proclaiming that all God's promises are coming true. He's the one that the Solomon story awaits. So while we've reached the end of Solomon, and what a sad and sorry end it is, we've also reached, as it were, the launching point for the greater son of David, the story of Jesus, the king who doesn't disappoint, the one who takes our broken hearts and broken dreams and puts them back together again, the one who banishes our disillusionment and brings a true and eternal hope. This is our King. If you don't yet know him personally, come to him today. If you do know him, rejoice in him today. Wherever we find ourselves this morning, we can confess our idolatries and failures, our disappointments and disillusionment, and bring it all to the throne of grace of our great King, Jesus.